Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
People are very clearly more and more saying they don't want chemicals and drugs in their food system. That is so clear. It's so loud and clear. And the mainstream beef industry is still not getting that message.
Nicolette Hahn Nyman hopes her book will show the way forward for the beef industry. Her suggestion? Put as many cows on grass as possible. From Harvest Public Media, how low corn prices are affecting beginning farmers. Then it's three different meals. Chef Daniel Orr makes salmon on a cedar plank. He ditches the meat entirely and broils up some king oyster mushrooms. And what about a meal for people who don't like food? We've got that too, believe it or not, coming up today on Earth Eats. A roundup of food news with Luann Johnson.
Monsanto agreed to pay $2.4 million to wheat farmers and organizations this week. That's part of the settlement of a lawsuit over GM wheat. U.S. regulators have not approved any genetically engineered wheat, but last year, GM wheat was found growing in a field in Oregon. Countries that import American wheat were spooked by the discovery. Japan and South Korea temporarily stopped buying wheat from the U.S. Farmers in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho will receive money from the settlement. It might be time to rename so-called comfort foods. A new study released in the journal Health Psychology decided to test if comfort foods made people in blue moods feel better. Participants self-identified their favorite comfort foods, then watched a 20-minute video designed to induce anxiety and sadness. Once the participants were down, they were separated into three groups. One received a comfort food of choice, one received a neutral food, and the third received no food. Foods classified as comfort did improve mood, but so did any food, or no food at all. So, what really cures a bad mood? Time, and the innate ability to feel better. There is one caveat. If a person believes the food will improve mood, then it might, based solely on the placebo effect. Americans are eating out less and less, according to figures collected by the market research company NPD. Restaurant visits are at a 30-year low, only 74 times a year. Takeout, which has been on the rise since the mid-1980s, also seems to be leveling off. Does this mean people are cooking more often? Well, no. The Washington Post spoke with Harry Balzer, chief industry analyst and vice president of NPD. Balzer says we're eating more packaged and processed foods at home instead. And what makes mayonnaise mayo? According to a lawsuit levied by the maker of Hellmann's, it's the eggs. Unilever is suing San Francisco startup Hampton Creek over the use of the name mayo in their eggless product, Just Mayo. Just Mayo uses Canadian yellow peas in place of eggs in their mayo-like product. Unilever is arguing that mayo has to contain eggs, as per FDA guidelines. Miracle Whip, for instance, is considered a salad dressing by those standards. The FDA created mayonnaise guidelines in 1957, and some food policy advocates argue the definition needs updating. Unilever isn't just up in arms over eggs. The company is concerned about the bottom line. Last year, mayonnaise outsold every other condiment in the U.S., and Unilever gets 45% of that market. Just Mayo is the first vegan product to challenge the food giant, showing up in Walmart stores and gaining backing from major contributors like Bill Gates. As part of the lawsuit, Unilever wants Just Mayo to pull all product and promotion from shelves that might confuse consumers, pay three times its profit plus legal damages, and stop claiming it's better than Hellmann's. Why not opt out of this mayo drama altogether and make your own? We've collected several links for homemade mayo. Find them at eartheats.org.
And we have a killer recipe for homemade ketchup, too. Our news from Luann Johnson. Thanks.
You know what's really good on a sandwich? Honey mustard. See you next week, Annie.
Corn and soybean prices have fallen to their lowest levels in recent years. That's bad news for most farmers, but it's hitting the next generation of farmers hardest. Harvest Public Media's Abby Wendell has the story.
Grant Curtis sits in the captain's chair of his combine. He drives back and forth harvesting rows of corn from his family's farm in Scioto, Illinois. Then he arcs the 80,000-pound machine off course towards a single stalk he missed.
right there's a prime example of trying to get the last little bit there. Trying not to leave any on the ground.
With corn prices down almost half from 2 years ago, every kernel counts, especially for beginning farmers like Curtis, who have less cash, fewer assets, and more debt. Slim profit margins mean young farmers are at risk of financial troubles now, and they're also less able to fortify their operations against hard times in the future. Unlike the older generation, younger operators typically don't own what it takes to farm. They have to buy it. Making those purchases is an essential step to becoming a stable and established business.
We were all spoiled little brats the past 2 years with $5, $6, and $7 corn. Yep.
During the good times, Curtis ran up a line of credit and took out several loans to pay for land, seed, fertilizer, chemicals, and equipment. He also installed drainage tile to improve the land's fertility, which translates, hopefully, to more profit in the future. But this year, Curtis won't be able to put money into the farm. He says he'll barely earn enough to cover the basics.
Those extra dollars that were available aren't going to be available for this year. That money is going to have to go to helping pay down the debt in addition to putting a crop in for next year.
The downturn has Curtis worried about his long-term role on the farm. In order to continue full-time, he needs to grow the operation into a self-sustaining business, and that takes more land. Curtis owns a little, manages a lot for other farmers, and cash rents some, which means that even though he has fewer dollars coming in, he still owes a fixed fee to his landowner. He hasn't set a date, but he plans to have a conversation soon about lowering the rent.
It's an awkward situation to be in. It'd be like going and asking for a lower rent at your house because you maybe had to go get a different job because you were laid off.
Curtis's parents pay him to farm their land. It's a big part of his income. But if the downturn persists, he'll have to do what a lot of beginning farmers have already done, take an off-farm job.
Hello.
Yeah,
you available right now?
Drew Calvert considers himself a farmer, but his day job is working as a seed salesman. He's been in agricultural sales since graduating from college in his early 20s. Now he's 34. During the harvest, he drives a company truck around rural Illinois to visit customers.
All right. See ya.
Calvert pulls up alongside Eric Riebling and rolls down his window to chat about soybeans and the weather. He says he enjoys the work, but what he really wants is to quit and farm full time.
That's my biggest goal, is to be self-employed. I mean, that's what I wake up thinking about. I really don't want to still be doing this when I'm 40, so.
The farm Calvert wants to own is his dad's. He rents a fraction of it now that he farms in the evening and on weekends, borrowing his dad's equipment. Last year, Calvert's dad came to him ready to talk about passing down more ownership. But when Calvert brought the topic up this year, his dad said no. He didn't want to saddle his son with a new farm in the midst of harder times.
The grain prices, they throw a new wrinkle into everything. So there's potential that things are going to get slowed down again. But I also sort of expect those things to happen, I guess.
Things might not move any quicker for Calvert next year. Some economists have speculated that profit margins could be even lower in 2015. Abby Wendell, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. Nicolette Hahn Nyman calls herself a lifelong environmentalist. She's worked at the Waterkeeper Alliance and the National Wildlife Federation. She's also a livestock rancher. She considers her work with cows an extension of her environmentalism. Her new book, Defending Beef, explains why. In fact, that was one of the driving forces behind writing the book in the first place, to recalibrate the conversation about raising cattle.
There's a lot that's being done wrong with cattle husbandry today, both in the United States and other parts of the world. But to me, the problems are not inherent in cattle or in beef. It's really human error.
When she says she's defending beef, she's not defending conventional feedlot operations. She's talking about well-managed grass-based farms. Nyman owns BN Ranch in Northern California. The cows on her ranch are completely grass-fed.
You know, the best place for them to be is in a situation where they're outdoors and they're grazing. They're exercising and they're eating vegetation that they themselves are harvesting through their own grazing. And what humans should be doing is to be managing those cattle as much as possible in such a way that their impact on the land is similar to how wild animals once grazed around the world.
She explains that this is actually helpful to the natural world. Cows graze the entire time they're awake. They live in densely packed herds.
The reason that that's beneficial for an ecosystem when they're well managed is because their mouths are clipping the vegetation, and that's like what we would do in our gardens with pruning. You have to prune away vegetation to keep the plant itself healthy. That stimulates that plant to grow. But even more importantly, it stimulates all of the other plants around it to be able to grow because you're getting rid of the shade. And they actually call that the thatch. When you have grasses that grow long and they dry out and they die, or even before they die, when they grow tall, they prevent all of the other later germinating seeds from germinating and from successfully growing. That's number one. Number two, the hooves of the cattle are actually, a lot of times you hear, oh, the trampling hooves, and then it's sort of said in a negative way. Well, it's true. Again, it's the key is good management. If they're not being managed correctly, the hooves can be a negative. But a well-managed grazing operation, the hooves are essential because they're actually pushing the seeds into the ground and they're pushing the vegetation into the soil, which is where the sort of biological action of the soil can take place. So the biological processes of recycling the nutrients that are in the plants and feeding the soil life happen better when you have that trampling of the hooves.
And then finally, there's the manure, which adds nutrients back to the soil. These three processes create a beneficial disturbance on the earth. Taking it a step further, she talks about this beneficial disturbance and how it can actually help mitigate climate change. Well-managed, grass-based cattle operations can actually help store carbon from the air in the soil.
You know, we all learned in elementary school that photosynthesis is the process where plants grow and they basically take carbon dioxide out of the air and then they use that for their own processes. The part we didn't learn in elementary school, and actually nobody really understood until about the last 20 years, is that what then happens below ground is essential. And basically, it goes like this. The plants bring the carbon from the air into themselves through photosynthesis, and then through their root structures and through fungi that live around the roots, as well as another substance that was just discovered in 1996 by USDA scientists called glomalin, which is a substance that coats the roots of the plants. There are billions of transactions that are taking place in the soil around the roots of these plants, especially grasses. Grasses are the best for this, where the carbon is then exchanged for the nutrients, and the nutrients go to the plant, and the carbon goes into the soil. And with lots of glomalin in soil, that's only present in really healthy soils, the carbon is then encapsulated and stays in the soil.
That is, as long as the soil is not being plowed, you need undisturbed subterranean environments to successfully sequester carbon. And she says that's where grasslands and grazing areas come in. Her book is meant to encourage farmers to reform their practices, so what can the consumer take from it? Buy grass-based animal products.
I really encourage people to look in their communities for where they can get the dairy products and where they can get the beef, where the animals are actually on grass as much as possible. And the options are there. You often have to leave your grocery store to find it, but it's there.
Nyman admits that she's an insider. She raises cows, after all. Her book, then, is a constructive criticism of her industry. She hopes fellow ranchers will see her suggestions as a way to move forward.
Being a part of you know, a ranch for the last decade and knowing really good ranchers around the country, I really want the beef industry to survive. And what I see happening, you know, Americans are eating 22% less beef over the last three decades. Americans are cutting down on their beef. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but my point is, if the beef industry doesn't want, you know, this to continue, you know, to go down, 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 they need to listen to the concerns of people in the environmental community and people in the health community and really make sure that the practices that are being engaged in across the industry are matching people's expectations as far as animal husbandry and as far as land stewardship and in terms of the safety and quality of the meat that's produced. People are very clearly more and more saying they don't want chemicals and drugs in their food system. That is so clear. It's so loud and clear. And the mainstream beef industry is still not getting that message. So I'm really hoping my book will be received by the beef industry as a sort of a really constructive criticism of how to go forward in a positive way.
Nicolette Hahn Nyman is a rancher, an environmental attorney, and an author. Her new book is called Defending Beef: The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. More from my conversation with her is at eartheats.org. Ahead, we're making snacks with Chef Daniel Orr, starting with some king oyster mushrooms.
So what I'm going to do with these is just cut them in half, leave them, I mean, they're so dramatic looking, that I'm going to leave them really nice and big and chunky.
After that, we meet someone who sometimes prefers not to eat food at all. That's where Soylent comes in. That's coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with five locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. We spent a lot of time in the first half of the show talking about beef. So I asked Chef Daniel Orr to make us a couple no-beef recipes. Our first is salmon on a cedar plank. You could do this in the oven or on the grill if you want to bundle up and brave the elements. Today, Chef Orr is using a broiler.
It's a good, kind of a unique way of preparing salmon. And what we've done is we've got a cedar plank here. You can smell that. Smells kind of like a sauna.
Yeah, it does.
You know, and we're going to give the salmon a sauna of a lifetime. Just giving, I've got some of Tim Burton's maple syrup from Burton's Maple Camp.
1 gallon jug of the stuff.
And this stuff is good.
Great.
Okay, we're going to put a little bit of red onion. Okay, I've got a little bit of Meyer lemon. My cousin Heather down in Florida grows, actually she steals Meyer lemons from her neighbor and sends them up to me.
Steals.
And then you can take this whatever direction you want. You know, Chef Dan loves his lemon zest, loves his little crushed red pepper flakes. Okay, we're going to just kind of turn the salmon over in the mixture. And what the maple syrup's going to do is it's going to kind of intensify the smokiness of the cedar plank we're using, as well as caramelize. So get a nice kind of caramelization. All right, so what I'm going to do is I've got the smoking plank. I'm going to put a couple of the slices of Meyer lemon down. Then we put the salmon right on top, any of those leftover onions. Okay, and we're going to put that back up under the broiler. And we're going to let that cook through. I like my salmon still, you know, medium rare on the inside, so kind of translucent pink. What I would suggest is you just keep a good eye on it. We're going to let that cook for, I would say, 5 to 7 minutes. And you can do all different kinds of meat on here. You could do small birds like quail or thinly sliced, like thin chicken breasts on a plank. I actually had some smoked venison the other day that was delicious that a friend had smoked. It was sliced really thin, still quite rare, and almost like a prosciutto.
Dousing the fire. I think the plank has seen its last salmon fillet. All right, we're going to give this a taste. This
will be the fattier part.
Toward the end?
Towards the end, that's the belly part. Taste all that maple.
That maple syrup is so nice. It's not sweet. It's not in your face.
He doused the flame, popping off the plank with a squirt of juice from a lemon. Check out these photos. They're beautiful at eartheats.org. We're staying by the broiler for our vegetarian dish now, mushrooms. Who needs meat when you have these huge oyster mushrooms?
What they look like is an oyster mushroom on steroids. You know, I mean, they're giant. They've got this wonderful stem on them. They're meaty. So what I'm going to do with these is just cut them in half, leave them. I mean, they're so dramatic looking that I'm going to leave them really nice and big and chunky and have a real simple presentation. A little bit of olive oil on top, just enough to lightly coat them. All right, then we got salt and pepper. I'm going to put them on a roasting pan and throw them up under the broiler. And that is it.
That's it?
Yeah, and that will take probably about 3 to 5 minutes under the broiler.
So you're treating these like a main course then?
Yeah, this would be, they're almost like a steak. They're so meaty. You could do, if you can't find the king mushrooms, you could use portobello mushrooms a lot the same way. Even in the time when chanterelles are around, you could do the same recipe with chanterelles. All right, so we pull these out of the broiler. You can see they're nicely browned. That kosher salt's kind of crunchy on top of them. We're going to take a half lemon, just squeeze a little bit of that on top. Okay, a little touch of truffle oil. Okay, and here I've got a nice Napa cabbage leaf. Okay, we're going to put 3 of these mushrooms on top of the Napa cabbage. And one of the nice things about this is I have some spinach arugula pesto. I put that on that Napa leaf. It gives a little bed of sauce underneath there. It plays off the green colors in the Napa. It's a little darker, more kind of gutsy green with that pureed spinach, Parmesan cheese, and arugula with a little bit of garlic, salt, and pepper. And we're going to call that a day. Nice, simple presentation. You know, lovely as an appetizer. You could add a couple other things to make it a main course, maybe some rice, some wild rice, some different mixed grains, and you'd have a wonderful vegetarian dish.
Notice those two recipes were finished with some fresh lemon juice. Now, Chef Daniel Orr cannot emphasize enough how important it is to have real lemons on hand. The bottled juice just isn't the same. These recipes are at eartheats.org. And now we've got a recipe for, well, no, it's not really a recipe at all. And gosh, it's not even really food. Here, just listen.
So yeah, this is the, comes in like a zippy, you know, like dried fruit or granola or something would come in.
This is what breakfast sounds like.
I'm just making it in these protein smoothie bottles. Okay, I am Katie Thompson.
That's a lot of powder. It's like
is.
A half cup.
It is.
It smells like pancakes.
Yeah, it does. It really does. And it's funny because now I'm associating it just with like, oh, this is what food smells like.
1 scoop powder, 2 scoops cold water. That's what it takes to prepare a glass of Soylent.
So yeah, and then you just... Yeah. And then you just pop the lid and that's it.
And breakfast.
Yeah. I was like trying to feed some to the microphone. I don't know.
It's a nutritional drink that Katie says provides all the nutrients she needs for one meal.
I'm going to taste a little bit right now, which I'm sort of excited about. What do you say to people when they ask you to describe what it tastes like?
That's the first question everybody has, is what does it taste like? It's really mild. It's I've heard people say like pancake batter, and that's kind of looks like it too. Yeah, it's very mild. The only thing that I'm not crazy about is it is a little, it's a little gritty. It's a little chalky because of all the fiber in it. But yeah, here.
It smells like pancake batter. That's amazing.
It really, it's not going to be as gross as you think it is.
Yeah, that's pancake batter. Like, spot on.
Yeah.
Same consistency as pancake batter, too. The real food eaters in her life, now I'm using air quotes there for real food, those people are also just really confused by her decision to add Soylent to her diet.
A lot of it is just like, that's just wrong. How could you? I could never do that. I get a lot of I could never do that. But being vegan, I'm used to that. So this is, I think this is just another step of like a weird way that I'm nourishing myself that no one around me really understands.
That's right. Katie is vegan. The Soylent powder is vegan, so she's able to consume that. There are additional oils you can squirt into the drink to add nutrition, but those contain animal products, so she just opts out of those. She doesn't drink this every meal. It's more for convenience, when she's on the go or when she's eating alone at home. At times like that, she considers eating a chore. This is also a way for her to add nutrients to her diet. She admits that her real food vegan diet consisted of packaged and sugary foods.
If I can like do this chore much more effectively, like it's going to be better for everyone. It's going to take the same amount of time and I'm going to get way more nutrition.
Do you feel full after you have one of these?
I kind of had to learn to feel fullness differently. One of the first times I had it, I was like so excited. I'm like, oh, you know, I poured myself a big glass of Soylent and I drink it. And I was like, yeah, I just ate dinner. And yeah, I wasn't hungry anymore, but I also didn't feel full.
Her solution? Sip it slowly over 10 to 15 minutes. Another question she gets a lot.
You do poop less. You do still poop, but you poop a lot less. I'm just saying.
Thanks to Katie Thompson for letting me crash her kitchen. May I encourage all of our real food-loving listeners to do the cooking thing with recipes. Plan your next meal with the help of eartheats.org. Our Earth Eats team includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, Casey Zakin, and all the folks at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thank you for tuning us in today. Enjoy some good food. I'm Annie Corrigan.